These are desperate times, Blaine. Smuts was speaking softly. Storm clouds are gathering all around us. We need a united people. We need a strong coalition cabinet, not a parliament split by party differences. Our economy is tottering on the brink. The gold mining industry is in jeopardy. At present costs, many of the older mines are already closing down. Others will follow. And when they do, it will mean the end of the South Africa that we know and love. In addition to that, the price of wool and diamonds, our other major exports, have crashed. Blaine nodded soberly. All these factors were the basis of nationwide concern. I don't have to emphasize the findings of the Wage Commission, Smuts went on. One-fifth of our white population has been plunged by drought and primitive farming methods into abject poverty. 20% of our productive lands have been ruined by erosion and abuse, probably permanently. The poor whites, Blaine murmured. A great mass of itinerant beggars and starvelings, unemployed and untrained, without skills, without hope. Then we have our blacks, split by 20 tribal divisions, flocking in from the rural districts in search of the good life, Dilekelu, and swelling the ranks of the unemployed, finding instead of the good life, crime and illicit liquor and prostitution, building up a pervading discontent, conceiving a fine contempt for our laws and discovering for the first time the sweet attractions of political power. Oh, that is a problem we haven't even begun to address or attempt to understand, Blaine agreed. Let us pray our children and our grandchildren do not curse us for our neglect. Let us pray indeed, Smuts echoed. And while we do so, let us look beyond our own borders for a moment, to the chaos which engulfs the rest of the world. He stabbed at the earth with his cane, to mark each point as he made it. In America, the system of credit has collapsed, and trade with Europe and the rest of the world has come to a standstill. Armies of the poor and dispossessed roam aimlessly across the continent. He stabbed the point of the cane into the turf. In Germany, the Weimar Republic is collapsing after ruining the economy. 150 billion Weimar marks to one of the old gold marks, wiping out the nation's savings. Now, from the ashes, has risen a new dictatorship, founded in blood and violence, which has upon it the stench of immense evil. He struck the earth again, angrily. In Russia, a ravening monster is murdering millions of his own countrymen. Japan is in the throes of anarchy. The military have run riot, cutting down the nation's elected rulers, seizing Manchuria, and slaughtering the unfortunate inhabitants by hundreds of thousands, threatening to walk out of the League of Nations when the rest of the world protests. Once again, the cane hissed as he slashed at the lush Kikuyu grass. There has been a run on the Bank of England, Great Britain forced off the gold standard, and from the vault of history the ancient curse of anti-Semitism has escaped once more and stalks the civilized world. Smut stopped and faced Blaine squarely. Everywhere we turn, there is disaster and mortal danger. I will not attempt to profit from it, and in so doing divide this suffering land. No, Blaine. Coalition and cooperation, not conflict. How did it all go wrong so swiftly, Ubas? Blaine asked softly. It seems just yesterday that we were prosperous and happy. In South Africa, a man can be filled with hope at dawn and sick with despair by noon. Smuts was silent for a moment, and then he roused himself. I need you, Blaine. Do you want time to think about it? Blaine shook his head. No need. You can count on me, Ubas. I knew I could, said Smuts. Blaine looked beyond him to where Santayne sat under the oaks and tried to hide his jubilation and suppress the sense of shame that underlaid it. Shame that, unlike this saintly little man before him, he was to profit from the agony of his country and the civilized world. Shame that only now, out of despair and hardship, he would achieve his cherished ambition of cabinet rank. Added to that, he would be returning to the Cape, coming in from the desert lands to this lush and beautiful place. Coming into where Santayne Courtney was. Then his gaze flicked to the thin, pale woman in the wheelchair, her beauty fading under the onslaught of pain and drugs, and his guilt and shame balanced almost perfectly his jubilation. But Smuts was speaking again. "I will be staying on here as a guest at Veldhoven for the next 4 days, Blaine. Sir Garry has bullied me into agreeing to allow him to write my biography, and I will be working with him on the first draft. At the same time, I will be conducting a series of secret meetings with Barry Herzog to agree the final details of the coalition. This is an ideal place for us to talk, and I would be obliged if you could keep yourself available. I will almost certainly be calling upon you." "Of course." With an effort, Blaine set his own emotions aside. "I will be here as long as you need me. Do you want me to submit my resignation to the administrator's office?" "Draft the letter," Smuts agreed. "I will explain your reasons to Herzog, and you can hand it to him in person." Blaine glanced at his watch, and the old general said quickly, "Yes, you will have to prepare for your match. This frivolity, in the midst of such dire events, is rather like fiddling while Rome burns, but one must keep up appearances. I have even agreed to present the prizes. Santayne Courtney is a persuasive lady. So, I hope we will meet later, at the prize-giving, when I hand you the cup." It was a close thing. But the Cape A team, led by Blaine Malcomus, held off the most determined efforts of the Transvaal A in the final match of the tournament to win by 3 goals. Immediately afterwards, all the teams gathered at the foot of the grandstand, where the array of silver cups was set out on the prize table. But there was an awkward pause in the proceedings. One team was missing. The junior champions. "Where is Chasseur?" Santayne demanded in a low but furious voice of Cyril Slane, who was the tournament organizer. He flapped his hands and looked helpless. "He promised me he would be here." "If this is his surprise..." With an effort, Santayne hid her anger behind a gracious smile for the benefit of her interested guests. "Well, that is it. We begin without them." And she took her place on the frontier of the stand beside the general and held up both hands for attention. "General Smuts, ladies and gentlemen, honoured guests and dear friends." She faltered and looked around uncertainly, her voice overlaid by the drone in the air, a sound that rose steadily in volume, becoming a roar, and every face in the crowd was lifted to the sky, searching, some puzzled, others amused or uneasy. Then suddenly, over the oaks at the far end of the polo field, flashed the wings of a low-flying aircraft. Santayne recognized it as a puss moth, a small single-engine machine. It banked steeply towards the grandstand and came straight at them, no more than head high, as it raced across the field. Then, when it seemed it would fly straight into the crowded stand, the nose lifted sharply and it roared over their heads, as half the spectators ducked instinctively and a woman screamed. In the moment that it flashed over her, Santayne saw Chasseur's laughing face in the side window of the aircraft's cabin, and the flicker of his hand as he waved. And instantly, she was transported back over the years through time and space. The face was no longer Chasseur's, but that of Michael Courtney, his father. In her mind, the machine was no longer blue and streamlined, but had assumed the gaunt, old-fashioned lines. The double deck of wings and wire riggings and the open cockpit and daubed yellow paintwork of a wartime scout plane. It banked around in a wide circle, appearing once more over the tops of the oaks, and she stood rigid with shock, and her soul was riven by a silent scream of anguish as she watched again the shot-riddled yellow scout plane trying to clear the great beech trees below the chateau of Mortomme, its engine stuttering and missing. "Michael!" She screamed his name in her head, and it was like a blinding flash of agony as once again she watched his mortally wounded machine hit the top branches of the tall copper beech and cartwheel wing over wing as it fell out of the air and struck the earth to collapse in a welter of broken struts and canvas. Again she saw the flames bloom like poisonous, beautiful flowers and leap high from the shattered machine, and the dark smoke roll across the lawns towards her, and the body of the man in the open cockpit twist and writhe and blacken as the orange flames sucked upwards and the heat danced in glassy mirage and greasy black smoke and filled her ears with drumming thunder. "Michael!" Her jaws were locked closed, her teeth aching at the pressure, and her lips were rimmed with the ice of horror, so that the name could not escape from between them. Then, miraculously, the image faded, and she saw instead the small blue machine settle sedately onto the green turf of the polo field, its tail dropping onto the skid, the engine beat dwindling to a polite burbling murmur as it swung around at the far end of the field, and then taxied back towards the stand, the wings rocking slightly. It stopped below them, and the engine cut out with a final hiccup of blue smoke from the exhausts. The doors on each side of the cabin were flung open, and out tumbled Chasseur Courtney and his three grinning teammates. It amazed her that they had all crammed into that tiny cockpit. "Surprise!" they howled. "Surprise! Surprise!" And there was laughter and applause and whistles and catcalls from the stand. An aircraft was still a marvellous novelty, able to attract the attention of even such a sophisticated gathering as this. Probably not more than one in five of them had ever flown in one, and this unexpected and noisy arrival had created an excited, laughing mood, so that the applause and comment was loud and raucous as Chasseur led his team up to the prize table to accept the silver cup from General Smuts. The pilot of the blue aircraft climbed out of the left-hand door, a stocky, bald-headed figure, and Santaine glared at him venomously. She had not known that Jock Murphy included flying among his assorted accomplishments, but she determined that he would rue this prank. She had always done all she could to discourage Chasseur's interest in aircraft and flying, but it had been difficult. Chasseur kept a photograph of his father in flying gear beside his bed, and a replica of the SE-5A fighter plane hung from the ceiling of his bedroom. Over the last few years, his questions about flying and his father's military feats had become more insistent and purposeful. She should have been warned by this, of course, but she had been so preoccupied, and it had never occurred to her that he might take to flying without consulting her. Looking back, she realized that she had been deliberately ignoring the possibility, deliberately avoiding thinking about it, and now the shock was all the more unpleasant. With the silver cup in his hands, Chasseur ended his short acceptance speech with the specific assurance, "Finally, ladies and gentlemen, you might have thought that Jock Murphy was flying the Puss Moth. He was not. He wasn't even touching the controls. Were you?" He looked across at the bald-headed instructor, who shook his head in collaboration. "There you are," Chasseur gloated. "You see, I have decided that I am going to be a flyer, just like my dad." Santaine did not join in the clapping and laughter. As suddenly as they had arrived and transformed the life of Veldhoven, the hundreds of guests had gone, leaving only the ruined turf of the polo ground, the litter and the mountains of empty champagne bottles and piles of dirty linen in the laundry. Santaine was left also with a feeling of anticlimax. Her last flourish had been made, the last shot in her arsenal fired. And on the Saturday, the mail ship docked in Table Bay and brought them an uninvited but unwelcome visitor. "Damn fellow reminds me of an undertaker standing in front of the tax collector," Sir Garry huffed, and took General Smuts off to the gunroom, which he always used as a study when he visited Veldhoven. The two of them were immersed in the initial consultations for the biography and did not appear again until lunchtime. The visitor came down to breakfast just as Santaine and Chassa arrived back from their early morning gallop, rosy-cheeked and starving. He was examining the hallmarks on the silver cutlery as they entered the dining room arm in arm through the double doors, laughing at one of Chassa's sallies. However, the mood was instantly shattered, and Santaine bit her lip and sobered when she saw him. "May I introduce my son, Michael Chassa Courtney? Chassa, this is Mr. Davenport from London."
"How do you do, sir? Welcome to Veldhoven."
Davenport looked at Chassa with the same appraising stare with which he had been examining the silver. "It means well satisfied," Chassa explained. "From the Dutch, you know. Veldhoven." "Mr. Davenport is from Sotheby's, Chassa." Santaine filled the awkward pause. "He has come to advise me on some of our paintings and furniture."
"Oh, jolly good," Chassa enthused. "Have you seen this, sir?"
Chassa pointed out the landscape in soft oils above the sideboard. "It's my mother's favourite. Painted on the estate where she was born. Moor Dom, near Arras." Davenport adjusted his steel-framed spectacles and leaned over the sideboard for a closer view, so that his considerable stomach drooped into the salver of fried eggs and left a greasy splotch on his waistcoat.
"Signed 1875, he said somberly. "His best period."
"It's by a chap called Sisley," Chassa volunteered helpfully. "Alfred Sisley. He is quite a well-known artist, isn't he, Mater?" "Cherie, I think Mr. Davenport knows who Alfred Sisley is." But Davenport wasn't listening. "We could get £500, he muttered, and pulled a notebook from his inner pocket to make an entry. A fine dusting of dandruff descended from his lank locks at the movement and sprinkled the shoulders of his dark suit.
500? Santaine demanded unhappily. "I paid considerably more than that for it."
She poured a cup of coffee. She had never taken to these huge English breakfasts, and she carried it to the head of the table.
"That is as may be, Mrs. Courtney. We had a better example of his work on auction only last month, L'Écluse de Marly, and it didn't reach the very modest reserve we placed on it. Buyer's market, I'm afraid. Very much a buyer's market."
"Oh, don't worry, sir." Chassa piled eggs onto his plate and crowned them with a reef of crispy bacon.
"It's not for sale. My mother would never sell it, would you, Mater?"
Davenport ignored him and carried his own plate to the vacant seat beside Santaine. "Now, the Van Gogh in the front salon is another matter," he told her, as he launched into the smoked kippers with more enthusiasm than he had shown for anything since his arrival. With his mouth full, he read from the notebook. "Green and violet wheat field. Furrows lead the eye to golden halos around the huge orb of the rising sun high in the picture." He closed the book. "There is quite a vogue for Van Gogh in America, even in this soft market. Can't tell you whether it would last, of course. Can't stand him myself. But I will have the picture photographed and send copies to a dozen of our most important clients in the United States. I think we can bank on £4,000 to £5,000. Chasseur had laid down his knife and fork and was staring from Davenport to his mother with a puzzled and troubled expression. "I think we should talk about this later, Mr. Davenport," Santaine intervened hurriedly. "I have set aside the rest of the day for you, but let us enjoy our breakfast now." The rest of the meal passed in silence. But when Chasseur pushed his plate away half-finished, Santaine rose with him. "Where are you going, Chérie?" "The stables. The blacksmith is reshoeing two of my ponies." "I'll walk down with you," she said. They took the path along the bottom wall of the Huguenot vineyard, where Santaine's best wine grapes were grown, and around the back of the old slave quarters. Both of them were silent, Chasseur waiting for her to speak, and Santaine trying to find the words to tell him. Of course, there was no gentle way of saying it, and she had delayed too long already. Her procrastination had only made it more difficult for her now. At the gate of the stable-yard, she took his arm and turned into the plantation. "That man," she began, and then broke off and started again. "Sotheby's is the foremost form of auctioneers in the world. They specialize in works of art." "I know," he smiled condescendingly. "I'm not a complete ignoramus, Mater." She drew him down onto the oak bench that stood at the edge of the spring. Sweet crystal water burbled out of a tiny rocky grotto and splashed down amongst ferns and green moss-covered boulders into the brick-lined pool at their feet. The trout in the pool, as long and as thick as Chasseur's forearm, came nosing up to their feet, swirling hopefully for their feed. "Chasseur, chérie," she said. "He has come here to sell Belty Braden for us." She said it clearly and loudly, and immediately the enormity of it came down upon her with the brutal force of a falling oak tree. And she sat numb and broken beside him, feeling herself shrinking and shriveling, giving in at last to despair. "You mean the paintings?" Chasseur asked carefully. "Not just the paintings. The furniture, the carpets, and the silver." She had to stop to draw breath and control the trembling of her lips. "The chateau, the estate, your ponies, everything." He was staring at her, unable to comprehend it. He had lived at Belty Braden since he was 4 years old, as far back as he could remember. "Chasseur, we have lost it all," she said. "I have tried since the robbery to hold it together. I was not able to do it. It's gone, Chasseur. We are selling Belty Braden to pay off our debts. There will be nothing left after that." Her voice was cracking again, and she touched her lips to still them before she went on. "We aren't rich any more, Chasseur. It's all gone. We are ruined. Completely ruined." She stared at him, waiting for him to revile her, waiting for him to break as she was about to break. But instead, he reached for her, and after a moment the stiffness went out of her shoulders, and she sagged against him and clung to him for comfort. "We are poor, Chasseur." And she sensed him struggling to take it all in, trying to find words to express his confused feelings. "You know, Mater," he said at last, "I know some poor people. Some of the boys at school. Their parents are pretty hard up, and they don't seem to mind too much. Most of them are jolly good chaps. It might not be too bad, once we get used to being poor." I'll never get used to it, she whispered fiercely. I will hate it, every moment of it.
And so will I, he said as fiercely.
If only I were old enough. If only I could help you.
She left Chassa at the blacksmith's shop and returned slowly, stopping often to chat with her coloured folk, the women coming to the stable doors of the cottages with their babies on their hips to greet her, the men straightening up from their labours, grinning with pleasure, for they had become her family. To part with them would be more painful even than giving up her carefully accumulated treasures. At the corner of the vineyard, she climbed over the stone wall and wandered between the rows of lovingly pruned vines, on which the bunches of new grapes already hung weightily, green and hard as musket balls, flowery with bloom. And she reached up and took them in her cupped hands, as though it was a gesture of farewell, and found that she was weeping. She had been able to contain her tears while she had been with Chassa, but now she was alone. Her grief and desolation overwhelmed her, and she stood amongst her vines and wept. Despair drained her and eroded her resolve. She had worked so hard, had been alone so long, and now, in ultimate failure, she was tired. So tired that her bones ached, and she knew that she did not have the strength to start all over again. She knew she was beaten, and that from now on her life would be a sad and sorry thing, a grinding daily struggle to maintain her pride while she was reduced to the position of a mendicant. For dearly as she loved Gary Courtney, it would be his charity on which she must rely from now on, and her whole being quailed at the prospect. For the very first time in her life, she could not find either the will or the courage to go on. It would be so good to lie down and close her eyes. A strong desire came upon her, the longing for peace and silence. I wish it was all over, she thought, that there was nothing, no more striving and worrying and hoping. The longing for peace became irresistible, filled her soul, obsessed her, so that as she left the vineyard and entered the lane, she quickened her step. It will be like sleeping, sleeping with no dreams. She saw herself lying on a satin pillow, eyes closed, tranquil and calm. She was still in breeches and riding boots, so that she could lengthen her stride, and as she crossed the lawns, she was running. And she flung open the French doors to her study, and panting wildly, ran to her desk and tore open the drawer. The pistols had been a gift from Sir Gary. They were in a fitted case of royal blue pigskin, with her name engraved on a brass plaque on the lid. They were a matched pair, handmade by Beretta of Italy for a lady, engraved with exquisite gold inlay, and the mother-of-pearl butts were set with small diamonds from the Harney mine. She selected one of the weapons and broke it open. Every chamber was loaded, and she snapped it closed and cocked the hammer. Her hands were steady, and her breathing had eased. She felt very calm and detached as she lifted the pistol, placed the muzzle to her temple, and took up the slack in the trigger with her forefinger. She seemed to be standing outside herself, looking on almost without emotion other than a faint remorse, at the waste and a gentle sense of pity for herself. Poor Santaine, she thought, what an awful way for it all to end. And she looked across the room at the gilt-framed mirror. There were tall vases set on each side of the glass, filled with fresh, long-stemmed yellow roses from the gardens, so that her image was framed within blooms, as though she were laid out in her coffin, and her face was pale as death.